is perhaps the man in the whole Senate. He's right on our campus, but he's perhaps in the whole Senate. He knows more about this than anyone, so we decided not to import anyone. Pastor Walter Snyder, you've seen him around, not always wearing that colorful costume, who's presently working on a Ph.D. here. He has been around in Synod. In addition, he attended both two of the prep schools of Synod and both seminaries, which ought to give him some kind of credentials. In addition to that, he has done advanced work other than in theology, in sociology and anthropology, and particularly the Navajo language. You may, some of you were here last year, you may have heard him in chapel reading scripture in the Navajo. He studied at the University of Arizona, Northern Arizona University, the University of New Mexico, and the University of Missouri. And he's also, in addition to doing Ph.D. work here, he's taking courses at St. Louis University. He has had a lifelong interest in the American Indian and has spent over 9 years serving as pastor in western New Mexico. So, Walt, we'll ask you to take over, please.
You know, when you're the last one of the season, as I think I am this quarter, you kind of wonder if someone's saying something, and considering the choice of speakers we've had this year, I'm probably a poor cork in the bottle for this quarter. I decided maybe I'd better wear the bright shirt this morning just in case the presentation was so dull that everyone wanted to go to sleep. The shirt would be bright enough to keep everyone awake instead. I'm not an expert in American Indian affairs. I question very much whether we have anyone like that in Synod. Because of the very diversified nature of the entire problem, for one thing. And secondly, I'm a little bit worried about the designation of expert or authority anyway. You know, it usually has one of two connotations. Either you know more and more about less and less until you know nothing at all, or else you're over 500 miles from home and nobody knows if you're telling the truth or not. In the latter point, at least, I can qualify, so... One of the problems, of course, that we have to deal with, I think, is the problem of stereotyping. We went through the phase where pretty well the country followed the dictates of Andy Jackson and said the only good Indian is a dead Indian. After that, we went through a phase where they were either ignored or deliberately pushed aside many times. Then we hit a period in the 60s where everything Indian was romanticized. Frankly, I don't recommend any of the books, really, that were written during the period of the 60s because they were not really written as scholarly works. They were written for public consumption, and as such, they gave the public what they wanted, not necessarily the facts in the matter. I'm more accustomed, really, to making my presentations to LWML groups, congregations, some pastors' conferences, and otherwise. But I like to think today that this is a very special occasion and that I'm dealing with educators and professional theologians, so far as the faculty is concerned, and with future members of the Office of the Holy Ministry, together with me and others in the years to come. Usually when you speak to these other groups, it's for the purpose of sensitizing on the one hand. Educational, it's also quite honestly always trying to get some additional money to keep programs and missions running. And there's really no sense trying to get money out of seminarians because they never have it. So this is going to be entirely different today. Some things that I would like to do to present you with some facts on the Native Americans of the past and the present, some facts on what our church and others have done in the past and are doing at the present time, some very real needs if our work is going to succeed, and some suggestions on what can be done at the present and in the future to make the work more effective. I had the privilege of being a member of Floor Committee 1, the Committee on Missions for the Convention in 1979. Those of you who have done sufficient reading are aware that the Board for Missions had come up with their mission affirmations prior to that time. We dealt with those, and I think we took some pretty good affirmations and we watered them down pretty badly. One of the problems that was facing our floor committee all the time was cut things down. I don't know from how high up these orders were coming, but they were coming from higher than what we were, at least. And so instead of dealing with a lot of the different ethnic groups individually in the way of resolutions, we kind of lumped the whole thing together, and we cut out a lot of things. Our initial meeting had added a few matters, both from the Indian Advisory Council and also a few additional matters that I had brought up in regard to the resolution on Native Americans. But when we met again just before the convention started, these were stripped out of it. The basic emphasis of what came out of it was simply for the recruitment of more Native Americans to become pastors. And we set a goal of 5 per year or 50 for the decade of the 80s. This was the original proposition that had come up in the mission affirmations, but it was an unrealistic one. It still is. I argued for it because I thought we needed something to shoot for and a target to pick up on, but I felt we needed a couple of other things with it, and I still think it's a mistake. It was left out of not only the Native American situation, but Hispanic and otherwise. And this is the recruitment of theological students, prospective teachers, and pastors and teachers who are Anglos, who are able and willing to go into this type of work. Secondly, coming from the Indian people themselves, there's a great desire that workshops be held in individual congregations in order to train lay Indian people for leadership positions in their congregations. Because we're facing them with different governmental structures than they're accustomed to, they're not with the same sits and labens so far as their understanding of the Lutheran confessions and a lot of other matters are concerned, and they have virtually no training at all in proper church practices. And this runs the entire gamut from voters' meetings through to making a lot of other decisions. Along with this, there was also a matter in there regarding the training of these Anglos who were interested in this work. And I realize that here all of you have a very heavy schedule and you're finding it rough, maybe particularly right now, to get everything finished before the end of the quarter. And when the matter is brought up, I know that it has been mentioned a number of times. The question is always raised, where are we going to find room in the schedule for additional classes? I still feel, though, very strongly that some particular training classes need to be added in cross-cultural training, particularly cultural anthropology, perhaps a history of the American Indian in brief and of our church's involvement with it. And in these ways, developing an understanding of what's going to be faced in going into this kind of work. I think it's great that a lot of classes are being offered here now that weren't offered at one time. But while some of them are very practical so far as the normal parish ministry is concerned, they're not always so practical in these cross-cultural situations. For instance, with the strong emphasis on pastoral counseling and much of the practical program here, a lot of the things that are brought out there, which are good and valid in normal situations, we might refer to them, absolutely won't work with a lot of the American Indians. For one thing, if you happen to be called in on a family counseling matter, marital problems particularly, If you're dealing with a matriarchal society, as many of our American Indian groups are, the Navajo in particular, it doesn't do a whole lot of good to come from the point of view that the husband should be the head of the house. Because among the Navajo, the wife owns the children, she owns the hogan, she owns the herds of sheep and goats, and if the old man comes home and finds his saddle laying out on out in the yard, he needn't knock on the door because it's over. He's had it. Now, I mentioned the stereotypes earlier, and the American Indians themselves are guilty to some extent today of re-stereotyping themselves. I say this all the way from Eugene Crawford, who's heading the National Indian Lutheran Board, because he comes on from a certain viewpoint and he's trying to say that these things are the things that all Indians want. Some of the Indians are doing it. If you go to the intertribal Indian ceremonial in Gallup some August, you can't tell one Indian from another half of the time insofar as the costuming they're wearing or anything else. At one time, you could tell most of the silver and turquoise jewelry that was made, whether it was Navajo, Hopi, or Zuni, because of the style and the type of work. They borrow from one another. They also borrow from one another in dress. At one time, the Navajo never wore feathers. They never wore long hair and braids, but a lot of them are doing it today. So we have the danger of stereotyping from that side, and also we probably each one have our own built-in stereotypes. As my good friend Professor Schmelder always says, all Indians walk in single file. The one I saw did. This is just about the point that a lot of people are at. People, because we're accustomed to a different way of life, they do a lot of crying about some things Indian as though these of themselves are abusive. Some of you may be aware of similar situations. I'm aware of some, for instance, among the Navajo where the tribe was trying to get them to use outhouses so they would have sanitary facilities some years back. They were building these and delivering them by truck, and a lot of the people didn't want to take them. Others who did take them used them to store their saddles in or something else instead of the purpose for which they were intended. Part of the reason for a reluctance to do this among traditional Navajo is because of their fear of witchcraft and the fear that someone might obtain a sample of the human feces and use it in the development of a hex against them. Others of them, for instance, had some nice new homes built, concrete floors, cinder block walls, good roofs, screens on the windows and everything, down in southern Arizona. And one of the first things they did was to take hammers and break the concrete floors out of these buildings. Because, number one, they were too hard to walk on all the time. The dirt was much easier. Number two, if you spilled anything on the floor, it didn't simply soak in. It had to be cleaned up. So we're facing a lot of situations that most people in our society and culture really have no understanding of at all. Perhaps I should give you a little bit of a history of Lutheran involvement with the Indians. I myself get a little bit tired of the perpetual breast beating that's going on. I agree with Dr. Schultz that there's a very real need for some genuine pater peccavis today, not only among minority groups, but just in general, not only for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, but for all Christians, as far as their lack of interest and lack of work many times in evangelizing people. But this doesn't mean that Lutherans have never had any concern, that they have never done anything. There are some who would lead us to believe that until the 60s or 70s, we did nothing in social ministry, we did nothing in black work, we did nothing in Indian work or anywhere else, really. However, the very first settlers from Sweden, who were Swedish Lutheran, who came over here and settled, came as one of their primary purposes to evangelize the Indians in that area. And I think it's a quite remarkable feat that only 100 years after Martin Luther wrote his small catechism, that the catechism was translated into the Delaware Indian language in 1629. There was a strong outreach among these people from these Swedish Lutherans. However, there were a number of factors that were detrimental to that work. Number one, that as more Swedes came in to work with these people, more Indians moved out because it was getting too crowded. Also, and if you think CPH is slow, wait till you hear this. When they had translated the catechism into Delaware, they shipped it back to Sweden for printing because we didn't have any printing presses over here at that time. It took over 30 years for it to get to Sweden, be printed, and get back. And by that time, there weren't any Delawares left in the area. Now, Lutheran involvement continued in Georgia, in New York, in Pennsylvania. It moved on into Wisconsin. It was up in the Saginaw Valley in Michigan. Again, the Lea people came over primarily to do Indian mission work there. But they came again to both evangelize and civilize the Indians. Now, I'm not saying that was always bad so far as motivation was concerned. These Bavarians who came over were honestly concerned about the whole man as we speak of him today. These Indians many times literally starved in the winter because the game was gone. There were no crops available or anything. And also, they simply were not accustomed to really storing things up. You eat when you've got it and you go without when you don't have it. And you still find some of this today. But as these people came in then to teach the Chippewa to farm and to store things away and to educate them and everything, again, the Indians began moving out because they didn't want to be civilized. They didn't want to farm. They wanted to hunt and fish. And they're one of the problems, I think, that has faced Christian churches in general, our own church in particular in its mission outreach among the Indians, has been a lack of adaptability in moving out where they were in times past and simply following them. That wouldn't have been an easy life for the missionaries. I'm not saying that, but probably that's what was really needed. Another thing was a different viewpoint insofar as teaching them the facts of Christianity. Now, I happen to remember when some of our churches were still going through the throes of changing from the German to the English language. Not all of them made it at the time of World War I. Some waited until World War II to do it. And the question was raised both times. Can we really preserve the pure doctrine if it's not taught in German? Well, the Lea Sendlinge there in the Saginaw Valley believed that they had to teach the Chippewas German before they could teach them Luther's catechism. Instead of simply translating it into Chippewa, teaching them to read and write their own language and working from that viewpoint. Work spread on westward. We also made attempts, and here I'm using we in the broad sense of all the Lutherans involved, into Minnesota, over into Nebraska, some work in the Dakotas, over into Montana, where our one and only martyr for the faith gave his life in a Crow uprising there. Also down into Kansas among the Potawatomi, down into Oklahoma, on out into Arizona, New Mexico. And yet today, when we look at the situation, it's hard to even identify how many Indian ministries all of the Lutherans have, because we're talking about a lot of different things when we talk about Indian ministries. One of the Indian ministries we're talking about is supporting an Episcopal endeavor in San Francisco, California. And while I'm on Synod's Board for Social Ministry, from which these funds came, I'm still wondering how come the Lutherans are supporting a social ministry of the Episcopal Church. So far as our own Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is concerned, we have 10 missions today. 8 of these are congregations, and 2 of them are what we call programs. 4 of the congregations are in Wisconsin, and we're probably in the process of losing 2 of them because they have an uncertified Seminex man as pastor there. We have another one on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, which is virtually brand new work, started by the man who had begun our LCMS work among the Navajo, Don Brenn. And there's the eighth one then at Navajo, New Mexico. And we have two in the state of Washington, at Nia Bay and at Push. There is the only full-blooded American Indian that we have. Don Johnson is a Macaw, and he's working with his own people. Don Brenn, who's on the Wind River Reservation, is part Chippewa. And the others who are at work are Anglos. The programs that we have are at Haskell Institute in Lawrence, Kansas, the large Indian school, and the other one, our Center for Indian Ministry and Study at Concordia College, Seward, Nebraska. There's a question, which social ministry actions might be considered ministry also. I'm a little bit dubious about them. Synod tried the grand experiment in the 60s. A man was called for full-time work to establish a synodical policy and develop programs in South Dakota. Out of this grew the National Indian Lutheran Board, the Lakusa Indian Desk, and other things. It's difficult to figure really how much funding has gone into it. Some came out of mission money, some came out of social ministry money, some came out of district monies, and so we don't really know. But to a large extent, the programs that have been involved there and elsewhere since that time out of that program have been in helping them to build canneries for canning fish, for providing fish traps in other places, for agricultural projects, and one of them of recent vintage was to buy 6 buffalo calves for the Indian Heritage Club at Seward. What? Seward at the present time in its program has 12 Indian students there. One of them is a Lutheran. Several of the others are Christians. Some of them are traditionalists. None of them is planning on going into the pastoral or the teaching ministry of the church. I think this raises some additional questions as to the educational programs that we're funding and the recruitment of Native Americans as to where we want to go in the entire matter. We're facing apathy, lethargy, even hostility on the part of some of our people who are in heavy concentrations of Indian people. There's no doubt about that. It's been around for a long time. Along with it has been sanctified stupidity. And by that I mean that very pious motives have been involved, but I think some very poor planning and execution at times. I don't have time for a full-blown course in American Indian history and Lutheran involvement, but such diverse characters as old Reverend Hartwick, who donated his money for the establishment of an Indian seminary in New York, down to James Fenimore Cooper. If any of you have ever read his boring literature, well, he's a fellow Lutheran. And he's absolutely fantastic in some of the wild things he comes up with at times, including his conclusion in the title of his one book, The Last of the Mohicans, because the last of the Mohicans is still alive and well today. The people that we work with up in Wisconsin, the Stockbridge, are the descendants of these Mohican Indians. Also, it's interesting to note that James Fenimore Cooper's father, who was the administrator of the funds for the Hartwick Seminary, absconded with most of them. In addition to this, we had men such as Lou Wetzel, who was quite a frontier hero in Ohio and elsewhere, in the days of the Indian problems there, who was known as Deathwind among the Delaware and the Shawnee because of his ongoing vendetta. Literally, to him, the only good Indian was a dead Indian. Of course, his entire family had been massacred. So it goes across a wide spectrum, and I suspect in the touch I have with the church today that we still cross about that wide a spectrum today. I've talked to Ed Schmidt, Synod Secretary for North American Ministries, a number of times, including very recently in regard to some of these things, and I've asked him, Ed, have you got any answers as to what we're going to do? And he said, not really. We both feel that the thing we have most of all is questions. Now, we have suggestions and we have ideas and feel that a lot of these at least need to be tried. I think we've made a start in the right direction of the appointment of an Indian Advisory Committee for Synod, which is made up all of LCMS Indians who are to be advisory not only to the Board for Missions but to all other boards of Synod and its committees and commissions in the regard of any work that's done among the American Indian today. I think it's a good idea because they are not running the show, on the other hand. They have very strong input into it. But just because you ask an Indian, as well as anyone else, what he wants or what he needs most, it's not necessarily true that you're going to get the best possible answer. This has been some of our problem, I feel, since the 60s, in that we were asking, and we were asking the wrong people, and we were being told that these were the things that were needed, housing, and agricultural projects and other things of that nature. However, the Indian Advisory Council itself said that the thing that was most needed, and this was incorporated into the resolution, to bring more and more Indians to a saving knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. And this is what it's all about. That's the direction I feel that our social ministry program has to take also in implementing the gospel ministry of our church. Not every social ministry program becomes a gospel ministry or even has any bearing on it. But I don't know of any of our gospel ministries among the Native Americans which is not also using a social ministry outreach. The two simply go hand in hand when they start with the gospel. The challenge for the 80s specifically said, whereas the risen Lord has commanded us to make disciples of all nations, whereas Lutheranism in the United States as far back as 1855, they were a little bit late on their date, it should have been 1629, has been involved in work among Native Americans, and whereas in its constitution one of the objects of the Synod is the training of ministers and teachers for service in the Evangelical Lutheran Church, and whereas opportunities exist for the extension of the Synod's ministry among Native Americans, therefore be it resolved that the LCMS adopt the mission challenges for the 1980s of 50 Native Americans recruited, trained, and placed in full-time Native American ministries of the Synod, and be it further resolved that the Board for Missions, working closely with Native Americans, the Board for Higher Education, the Board of Parish Education, and Synodical Colleges and Seminaries, sharing one another's expertise, see to it that this challenge for the 1980s is met to the glory of God and the expansion of His kingdom among Native Americans. That was the high-sounding challenge that was presented to us. The actual resolution, as it was finally adopted by the Synod, there were two of them, actually. One was to encourage growth of special ministries, which was Resolution 1-13, and covered the Hispanic, the Native American, and all the others. The other, then, was Resolution 1-14A. Among the resolves, and just to encapsulate these, that using the American Indian Task Force report, that they adopt the goal of more American Indian people believing in Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior through a meaningful proclamation of Jesus Christ, complemented by a concern for and a ministry to the whole person. Then that the American Indian Advisory council be established, that they be held responsible to the board for missions, but also advisory to all the other boards and committees of synod, that a biennial national conference of Lutheran Indians be held, and that the other considerations of the task force report then be studied and implemented by the board for missions as they were practical. One of the really hot potatoes at that time was the fact that just a few months before that, Synod's Board of Directors had voted to withdraw funding of the National Indian Lutheran Board and to discontinue our support of it. This generated more heat than light, probably, especially from those who favored continuing the relationship. I know I came under some severe attack in the floor committee meeting because it was my congregation in Gallup that submitted one of the resolutions urging Synod not to reestablish its relationship with the National Indian Lutheran Board or the Lakusa Indian Desk. We were accused of white paternalism, I think was the nicest term that was used. And the interesting thing was that my head elder, who signed the resolution, was a full-blood Choctaw Indian. The chairman of my congregation, who also signed it, was married to a full-blooded Zuni woman. Two of the other men who were on the church council that drafted the resolution were part Indian, and the other three on the church council were all working among the Indians. So there's a wide divergence of opinion there, and part of it, I don't think I'm going to judge motivation as to what moves people to decide the one way or the other. I want to give some time for questions because I think a lot of things that I would otherwise say will come up in the questions. But before I do, I would like to project what I feel a few needs are. And also, when I project these needs, I think that they're ones that can be realistically met. I think, first of all, is to have a clear-cut purpose in what we're going to try to accomplish in Indian ministry. And I think that the purpose is best of all illustrated from the 10th chapter of Romans. I was going to read it in Navajo, but you wouldn't understand it anyway. This from the 14th and 15th verses, where St. Paul raises the questions there. How shall they hear without a preacher? How shall they preach except someone be sent? How shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? The very basic question of all. And I think that's got to be the first and foremost purpose at the present and in any future expansion of our work. That it has to be done, every bit of it, in a concern for the proclamation of the saving gospel. I think we need to avoid stereotyping along the modern lines as much as we need to avoid following the stereotypes of the past. I sat up last night for a little while and watched John Wayne's old horse opera, Tie a Yellow Ribbon. Some of you may have seen it, or some of the others. It tickles me because it was my people, as I like to call them, the Navajo, who played most of the roles in most of these big John Wayne westerns. In fact, John Wayne was a great hero to the Navajo, in spite of all the Indians that he killed in the movies all the time, because he was a man who had a big ranch just off the edge of the reservation. He was very supportive of a lot of their programs, and he thoroughly understood them and liked them for what they were. And this is very basic, knowing them as they are. And it's interesting sometimes also then in watching these things to listen, because I can pick up enough of the Navajo that when someone is being questioned in Sioux or Arapaho or Shoshone or Cheyenne or whatever, invariably the answer is in Navajo. And the interpretation into English isn't always what the Navajo said either. This was particularly true in the film on Custer's Last Stand. We need to know the culture. This is a thing that I'm trying to work in. Some of my work in the past has been specifically directed that way. Oklahoma University, 11 years ago, published my thesis on the peyote cult among the American Indians. My STM thesis was a systematics compend of Navajo theology. And I hope if I ever get to that point that I can get approval for a doctoral dissertation on a comparative analysis of five American Indian creation, flood, and Tower of Babel myths compared with the Genesis account. My reason for saying that we need to know the culture is because I think we need to pick up on the wisdom that St. Paul had when he said, I noticed your altar to the unknown God, and this is the God whom I have come to proclaim to you. And most people pick up on anthropology before they pick up on theology. And if you know where people think their roots and origins are, and if you can relate this to what Scripture tells us man's roots and origins were, and it's interesting, their sin. And I don't think we have any of the fairer sex here right now. It's also interesting in the majority of the creation or emergence myths that it's the women who commit the first sin, just as it is in Genesis. There are so many parallels that are brought through. If you don't read the myth or the legend for what the myth or legend says, but for what the myth or legend means. And one of the big problems that the church even has had in dealing with this is in listening to secular anthropologists and sociologists as they have dealt more with religious practices of people than with the theology of these people which is behind those practices. I myself feel that one of the best ways to begin an outreach in touching the Navajo is tying in on their concept of harmony. All of the ceremonies for healing and everything are done with the sense of harmony, to restore balance in the body, to restore a harmony between man and the God he's offended, to restore harmony between man and his fellow man. That's why all of the family and everyone else comes to these to take part in the blessings that come down during the ceremonies. And then to produce a broader harmony among the entire clan or the tribe or whatever it might be. And some of them, interestingly enough now, are also including in this consideration even the Anglos, that there would be harmony brought about between the Indian and the Anglo people. Now, when you try to understand culture, you can't simply say this is Indian culture. There's Navajo culture and there's subcultures within that Navajo culture. There's Papago and Pima culture. I remembered to mention your people too. And it depends even on the amount of westernization of many of these people as to what point they're picking up on in their own culture. So there's no one blanket thing that can be laid down even in a seminary training program which would touch it all. It would be on generalities and give you something to tie into and know where to look and how to go about building up and picking up on the thing. And another thing you have to watch for, if you read too old a works that are done, even quite scholarly ones, they're picking up on where the tradition and culture was at that time. And we talk, and I've heard it over and over again out of the National Indian Lutheran Board, that we need to help support and preserve Indian culture. I'm a firm believer in not going in and tearing everything apart and imposing our culture on them in the church or otherwise, lock, stock, and barrel, and giving them something that's totally alien. On the other hand, so much of the culture is dominated by the theology. Many people today are not traditionalist in the sense of actively practicing it or even knowing what they're doing if they do. They don't even realize how much of their daily customs are governed by the religious tenets behind those customs, the taboos and everything else that go in with it. Then there's the constant change.
We talk about the traditional Navajo dress, for instance, a red velvet shirt like this, or with the women, this type of blouse and the long skirt and everything. How old does something have to be traditional? That's about 100 years old. It came in from the traders and the influence of the officers' wives with their long skirts and everything at that time. Their entire religion was borrowed or stolen, whichever word you want to use, from the Pueblo peoples among whom they settled. It still goes on today. Elements of Christianity are beginning to work into a lot of the traditional religion, and I think I can successfully prove that one of the primary Navajo deities, who in some of the earlier legends had no name, since about 1918, 1919, has had a name. His name is Bigochidi. And checking out the roots of the words, I think he was named after the Model T Ford. I'm serious. Because Chitty is the Navajo word for an automobile, just like the old Ford used to do when it was idling. It'd sit there and chitty, 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 chitty. And the Bigot comes out of the root for son of. So if the white man was taking everything over and if he had a self-propelled vehicle now that didn't need horses, well, what more logical name for the great god than to call him the son of the automobile? And so we find these types of things going on, and people going into the work have to be sensitive to this and pick up on it. I mentioned the fact I think we need training programs for Anglo pastors. And I have been assured by Dr. Westcott that if we can come up with the men who really want to go into it, and if these men then we think are the kind who can really do the work, and if they're married, if they've got the kind of wives who can put up with it too, because I kid you not, it's rough in a lot of the reservation situations, particularly on the women. It's not all glamour and bright clothes and dances and ceremonies and everything. It's a lot of dust and mud and hunger and sullen looks and getting kids dumped on you for babysitting maybe for 2-3 days at a time while the family's gone. Getting up during the middle of the night as a pastor and pulling somebody's pickup out of the wash, which was dry when he went to town and which is running 3 foot of water when he comes back and he gets bogged down in it. All of this is part of the ministry. And unfortunately, at the present time, we've got one man that's going to be removed from the mission station that he's working in because he simply can't tie into this kind of thing. He's a good and an honest man. He's faithful and sound in doctrine, and I can say all manner of good things about him, but he simply can't relate. And part of it is his feeling that these things are not part of the ministry. And they aren't, if you want to read a job description, either on the call document or as far as what Scripture says. But if you're going to work successfully there, that's part of your old MOS, as the military used to say. And that may include building fences, putting shingles on your own house, and everything else. So it takes somebody who's able to adapt to a largely different type of life. But I've been told that if these men are found, identified, and found acceptable, Synod will make the money available to fund vicarages. And my understanding was beginning this coming year for Indian ministry vicarages so the men can get out in the field and see if this is what they really want, and so that the church can take a look at them and see how effectively they work there. And in that connection today, I'd like to get a list of names and your phone numbers or whatever of any of you who are really interested in it. Synod is also trying to identify what Indian students we might have on our campuses. We've got a couple of closet Indians on the campus here again this year. I'm using that term because when I chided Professor Hempelman and Professor Schmelder because they had reported to Synod that there were no Indian students on campus, I happen to know that there were a couple, and their answer was, well, they didn't put it down on their application form. We've got a couple of men who are out on vicarage this year who are also part Indian.
couple of others who were interested in this type of work, and we didn't have the Indian Ministry Vicarages available. But I think it needs field work, and I think this is the way, because I really think that if we get some of the districts to start some vicarage programs in places, we're going to have not only the vicars there, but then later we're going to have pastors, and we're going to have new stations being started this way in the way of an outreach. And right now we don't have anybody. The Colorado District has been trying to call men out of black work to go into Navajo work. I'm not saying a man can't do it or that he can't come from an established congregation or anything else. Some of us have. But I really think it would be a lot better if we would work actively to train men in the seminary for it, so in some instances they don't get hung up on a lot of established congregational procedures. I think we need to change report forms that go into the district. These things were designed for organized congregations. They weren't designed for that type of situation. It's interesting, though, that this institution did answer the letter of Reverend Schmidt, and Austin College did. None of the others had a month ago when I checked. None of our other synodical schools even bothered to take the time to answer the questions. It's been about the same kind of a response from the districts of Synod, because the districts are being asked through their mission execs to identify the Indian reservations located in your district, to identify urban Indian clusters, settlements, and areas, to indicate if your district has an Indian Ministries Committee or where the responsibility for programming for this ministry has been placed. I think that the last figure was three districts that had responded to the questionnaire. I'd like to share with you this thought that back in about 1969-70, I asked the Oklahoma District to go over into eastern Oklahoma right next to the Arkansas line and to begin work there. These people, the Choctaw, were largely Christian Indians, part of the five civilized tribes who came out of Georgia and Alabama and were moved out there. These people were Cumberland Presbyterians originally. The Cumberland Presbyterian Church had gone out of existence. There were five vacant church buildings sitting there. They hadn't had a resident pastor for 4 years, and they were lucky if they got some itinerant to come through two or three times a year to hold services. We could have had those five church buildings simply for the sake of sending a man in to serve them. It was a different administration in that district at that time, but so far as I know to date, the Oklahoma District still has not even sent anyone over to make a survey. And the Church of Christ has taken over three of them now. We have got to learn to move a little more quickly. We have to have established policies and procedures, but we have to have people who can think along with a vision that's offered. And we need men to go into the ministry among the Native Americans who can have this same kind of vision. Men who are doctrinally sound, faithful to their Lord Jesus Christ and to the proclamation of his gospel, but men who can think on their own, and we need districts and others to start letting them think on their own. What will work in one place and work effectively is not necessarily the best thing for another station. Now, there have to be some general types of guidelines, but we also have to have some freedom of thinking and freedom of action if we're really going to reach out and make any type of success of it at all. And I suppose I'd better stop at this point if we're going to have time for questions. Have plenty of time. I didn't want everyone walking out and going to lunch while I was still here. To me, it was interesting, very much so. About a year ago, I came in possession of a report that was written by one of the men of the Lutheran Church of Australia who is working among the Aborigines in the Finke River Mission. There, they were getting very big into the social ministry program, and one of the big thrusts at that time, and it's still going on at the moment, is mapping out of the original Aborigine lands to set these aside as perpetual reservations for them. He apparently It's quite a lengthy letter, about 8 pages. Actually, more of a report in defending himself against some of the mission executives and others, in that he had taken the cultural courses, the linguistic courses. He had involved himself in learning families and the family relationships and all the other nuances that went with the work. But he wasn't actively involved in the mapping program and was being criticized for it. And his argument was that the church was now getting to the point where it was so active in all of these programs that it wasn't taking time to minister to the real spiritual needs of these people, and that even when it was, that it was setting them aside too much as a cultural entity and not really trying to develop the larger bond of faith, and in that area, just across family groups even, they were worshiping separately. Homogeneity can be a great thing up to a point, but it can be overdone also. And I think we're facing both concepts in our American Indian ministry viewpoint today. The liberation theology on the one hand is having large inroads, and I think sometimes from the church growth program, some of the things that are developed there that basically are pretty good and are pretty effective are trying to be used there where they're not necessarily that effective. I recall some years back they conducted a Kennedy evangelism workshop, the first of three for us in our area, and I attended, and you know, one of the basic ideas of going out, knocking on the door, introducing yourself and pushing yourself into the apartment, and tell them that you're going to tell them about Jesus Christ and ask them where they're going to spend eternity if they die that night, and then pray them into being believers on the spot. Now, it's not going to work among a lot of the Indians, especially the reservation ones. You don't go up to a Navajo Hogan and knock on the door and say, "Hello, I'm your friendly neighborhood missionary, and I've come to tell you about Jesus Christ," and you walk in. People still disappear out in that country today. Also, in a lot of our thinking, we need to consider the use of females, pastors' wives, female parish workers, and others, because a lot of the work simply can't be done too effectively among the women by a man. So a lot of our thinking has to be reworked at that point. And also, one thing which I would like to see very much, I would like to see Synod find somebody, I think for a limited tenure, because I think we've got too great a proliferation of boards and committees and commissions and everything at the present time. I suspect we could all go to heaven if all the records at 500 and elsewhere burned. I think we do need somebody to be sent out to work, to really tour, to find out what's going on by our church, to identify points where he thinks or they think, maybe a couple of men to begin planning for outreach programs, to really start putting the pressure on some districts to get things going, to take some of these district men out and tell them, "Hey, look, here's what we find in this place. Here's where you should be starting work." We need somebody, I think, particularly if we're going to have training programs for pastors, we need to have somebody to write up this history. Bits and pieces have been done by a number of people, but nothing's really coordinated. We need somebody really who has a good confessional Lutheran viewpoint to produce something in the realm of cultural anthropology, to be used in training to sensitize people for reaching out. And it might well be the same man or the same committee of two or three men. And then, like I said, give them a time limit. If necessary, extend it for a brief time again. Bring the thing to a halt, and in the meantime, while they're working, start getting these programs going. I don't have any projections as to what's going to happen except this. Indian ministry is going to continue to grow very slowly. For those who are involved in it, it's going to provide an awful lot of joys on a one-to-one basis. And it's going to provide at times an awful lot of frustration, too. And I guess maybe in a sense, that's the entire ministry, isn't it? And sometimes the joys and the frustrations are the very same things. But with over 20 years in the ministry and three different types of parishes, one a military in part, one a town and gown ministry, and one among the Native Americans, I've loved them all. I found some of the same problems in some different ones, but everywhere I've gone, and I think this is one thing always to remember, they're people. They've got all of the weaknesses and all of the greatnesses that everybody else does. They're simply people. Sinful people in need of Christ's redeeming love.
You get for that. Thanks, Walt. We certainly appreciate this insight. We have time now if you have some specific questions. Yes, please.
To what extent, Walt, have you looked at successful Indian programs at the present time and try to analyze why they are successful and what they are doing? Or are there no successful programs today?
Paul, I think that any time you reach even one person for Christ, it hasn't been a failure. But I know what you're getting at, relative sizes and other things. I think there's one that, more than any other, has been a success. And this is the work of the Wisconsin Synod in Arizona among the Apache. And I think one of the biggest reasons for their success there, I know we have some problems with them down in the Phoenix area in some of the overlapping of Indian work there in the metropolitan area. But I think one of the greatest reasons for their success, and they went in there before the peace treaties were even signed in the 1880s. The first people they sent in were people who could adapt. I still think that's number one in the whole thing. Doctrinally sound, of course, but people who can adapt. The first man who went in there was a man who taught himself to cut stone, to do painting and wood carving, among other things, and used the Indian people to help build a church. But before they had ever gotten to that point, he had set down the Apache language in a written form, which it had not been. He developed an Apache dictionary. And along with this, as the church went on, it started out with schools, parochial schools. It has a very successful orphanage and abandoned children program, which goes on there. Oh, there are things that I don't like about it, too. But I mean, I think really there is the really great success story, because it's the one that's been going on the longest and has overall accomplished the most. I think Don Johnson's having some successes up in the state of Washington. He's working with his own people. I think one of the reasons for perhaps less success in Wisconsin was the problem that they had in keeping pastors there, in fact, even in getting pastors and then in keeping them. Dennis?
Yeah, I got two questions. The first one you can ignore if you want to. And the second one has to follow up on this. I got to spend a couple weeks on one of our reservations. And I'm just wondering, at one of our missions, who taught our those Indians who haven't enough time, time learning English, who taught them King James English? Who taught them page 5 and 15 with strict observance of all the maize and the shells and all that? So I'm talking about adaptability and worship, and if that has any bearing on their work. And the other question is, the Mormons have been rumored to be widely successful, especially out west. And I was wondering if you wanted to comment on their programs and what they're doing, and if we can't learn anything from the way they train and go about it.
Maybe I should only answer one. If I answer them both, I may take up all the rest of the time. I happen to know the particular place that Dennis is referring to. You might say I have an intimate acquaintance with it. It was not my congregation, but mine was not strictly an Indian congregation even. Actually, the man who began the work there did not begin with the Lutheran hymnal and the order of service, page 5. He began with the Navajo gospel hymnal and a more or less free form of service. That was more or less a developmental thing there in using it. And yet, in a sense, I guess because there was nothing printed out in the way of a more modern English, that's why it was used. The same form could have been used in more modern English. Basically, the problem doesn't really start there with our people, though. The whole singing problem comes in from very early days of the missionaries, in that they wanted to wean the Indians away from their heathen practices and felt this included the use of drums and gourd rattles and chanting. And so they taught them to sing a Western type of hymnody, rather, and tended to translate hymns into whatever the native Indian language was and adapt them to the familiar tunes, those familiar to the missionary. And now it's a thing almost when an Indian becomes a Christian, he doesn't expect to do chanting because this belongs to the heathen ways. So now we've got the culture clashing with itself, even the Indian culture making a clash within itself. As far as ceremony goes, most Indians like ceremony. And I think ceremony, even our Lutheran ceremony, can be a very meaningful thing. But I'll grant that it could be done on a much more understandable level of English. And I'm not sure that the new Lutheran hymnal is going to provide it either. Maybe this should be included in some of our thinking too, in the way we work. As far as what the Mormons are doing, those of you who have heard me talk about it before know that I'm firmly convinced that the Mormons are the most effective tool that the devil has at work in the Southwest, particularly. I think it's going to be determined by what yardstick you use for measuring as to what we call success. For one thing, they haven't brought anyone to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. Now, they've brought them into the programs of the church, and I continue to be amazed that they do it, because the Indian, at best, can only be a second-class Mormon. However, they have this initial touch point in their doctrine that Christ originally came over and spoke to and lived with the American Indians here long before the white man came, that they can say, see, we were here. And quite frankly, a lot of it has been simply buying of people, taking in groceries, isolated areas, going in and showing movies on battery-operated projectors, on taking their kids off to BYU or someplace else for an education. That's quite honestly where it's come in. And speaking only for the Navajo, quite frankly, I'm not sure they've been that successful there. I think in a lot of instances, the Navajo have been using them, while the Mormons have thought they were using the Navajo. You know, prejudice and con work and everything go back and forth. They don't work only one way. Because there's a strong prejudice among the Navajo, particularly yet against the Mormons from the old days, when they kidnapped the Indian kids and used them as virtual slaves in their homes, ostensibly also to Christianize them at that time. Same way, there's the prejudice of the Navajo against the white. There's a prejudice against other Indians. They refer to the Mexican, to the Anglo, They refer to the Indians, and they refer to themselves as the Diné, the people. They're separate and distinct. They're not even Indian. Not in their own way of thinking. They're separate, distinct, and better than the rest of them are. Their prejudice against blacks is particularly strong. Government teachers who are blacks who have come out there have encountered real opposition and even open hostility. And the lowest thing to a Navajo's way of thinking is a Mexican. And both of those go back to almost prehistoric days, at least early historic days here, because the Spanish and later the Navajo were the ones who came in and settled first, took over, and so the prejudices run clear back to that time. Also against the blacks, it was largely blacks that we had in our frontier troops. They were called the Buffalo Soldiers by the Indians. And so a lot of the hostilities against the blacks, the kids today don't even realize it, that they've simply been taught from home, you know, that these are people you despise. But way back, that's the reason for it. Carl?
Real quickly, while you were talking about, you know, the mission station, can you give us a quick idea of, you know, what you mean, you know, I mean, what really is a mission station? What kind of church or how would a family fit in a station?
Well, right now at the one we're trying to make a station, I had a preaching station there and held instruction classes at the Eastern Navajo Agency at Crown Point. We used homes of government teachers to worship in. As far as, now this is only speaking of the Navajo, although some similar situations apply elsewhere, that on a lot of reservations you can't buy land, you can only lease it for a site. And you have to prove that you're there for some good reason for the tribe. Being there to save their souls is not a good reason. But if along with it you put in a health clinic or a school, if you have after school, recreational activities for young people in the community and other things, you're much more apt to get a permit. I suspect what's going to be done at Crown Point is that the trailer chapel and the old trailer parsonage from the work at Navajo are going to be moved up to Crown Point if and when a man is procured for it. Usually it starts with out in that area, at least in the Southwest, with conducting a vacation Bible school, getting young people and others to come in and canvass beforehand, then to come down and hold the Bible school, maybe in the chapter house or somewhere else, then to try and follow up with the kids who have come to Bible school to try and get a Sunday school started, and just gradually begin building. This very good friend of mine who is married to the Zuni lady, he's worked for the Zuni tribe as high school teacher and director of their social welfare program down there for about 11 years, 10 or 11 years now. And he feels what we need to do there, because of the old hostilities that go clear back to the Pueblo Revolt in the late 1600s. The Zunis at that time drove the priest out and everything, tore the church down. And the church has never succeeded in getting back in there since. A couple of little buildings are there. And a lot of people become nominal Roman Catholics by baptism, but that's virtually the extent of it. He feels we need to send some man in as a social worker or as a teacher, quite possibly a trained pastor, actually, but to let him go in and start working that way, not even tell anyone that I'm a reverend, as he says, because forget it, you're going to turn a lot of them off. Work there 2, 3, 4 years to get the people's trust and confidence first, then maybe begin slowly having Bible classes among some of the Anglo teachers and inviting some of the neighboring Indian people in or whatever. And again, it's a thing of play it by ear, but a slow thing. The Zuni, they make no distinction. Everybody's the same, whether you're Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Pentecostal, Mormon, whatever it might be. You're all the same, and they don't like any of you.
Question over here.
Yes.
Okay, how receptive are the Navajos to the gospel? You mentioned Like, what I mean is, would they be ostracized by the rest for becoming Christians, and or do they mix the traditional religion with the Christian religion when they become Christians?
Actually, you ask a number of questions, loaded ones. As elsewhere, Rome has been very adaptable where it has gone in, hasn't even been too inquisitive about what a person really believed, as long as they were baptized, and if occasionally they came to Mass, it was all right if, well, I know the Roman Catholic Church at Wheatfields is one where they hold some of their ceremonial dances out in the church parking lot, simply because it's a nice, convenient, open space that's nice and smooth and everything. Some of them, I found this with one of our Lutheran Navajos who said, well, I'm not really that concerned, this was some years back, whether I'm a Lutheran or not, because I was a Catholic before I became a Lutheran, and maybe I'll become something else. Others of them still, and I feel very sorry for some of my Navajo friends who have become Christians, but who have so lived in the fears of the past, and the medicine bundle has been handed down to them from the generation before. And I've been assured we don't use it, but they're afraid to throw it away or anything, and so they hang on to it. And this one man in particular, he's wondering what he's going to do because he doesn't want to saddle his kids with the same thing and pass it on to that generation. I've tried to get him to give it to me so I could use it, you know, as an exhibit. But no, he's afraid to do that, but he says, before I die, I'm going to burn it. But see, he's afraid to right now because some of those old fears are still there, you know, that something might happen to him. How receptive they are, some are quite receptive, others are very hostile. Some, when they're taken into the church, don't stay because they happen to come from a family that's very anti-Christian, or they happen to work in a situation where they really get the pressure put on them. I know one lovely young lady, a nurse, who finally came back to Pastor Brennan and said, I still believe in my heart, but I can't come to church anymore, because she couldn't take the pressures at work from people. Others, it doesn't make that much difference. In places, the peyote cult has really blended traditionalism and Christianity along with the use of the peyote drug. Roy?
I also have two questions. Don't ignore the first one. First, do you think that the conversion of a Native American is as significant as the conversion of a non-Native American? The second one is, what do you think should be the first thing that we here at the seminary should do, the first step, you know, towards leading towards more conversion of Native Americans?
I'm going to try to answer your questions, but I want a little bit of clarification on the first one. Exactly what do you mean when you ask, is the conversion of a Native American more significant than the conversion of a non-Native American? You're trying to nail me, Roy, to see if I'll prefer the American Indian to the Hispanic, I think. I'm kidding you. But I think that this is part of the picture because, you know, We're trying to identify different types of ministry and where the priorities come in. I think it should be one of the priorities. I don't know the mind of God, first of all, and I'm not going to try to establish priorities as to who's more important. I do think that it is a very important one for this reason, that it has been to a large extent neglected, or even where it has been entered into, it has been come at from the wrong way to such a great degree that it has been virtually ineffective. I think they are significant. I get a whole lot disturbed at my own district, the Colorado district, on the priorities that they put on ministries. It's no sweat to get funding for a new church in a Denver suburb, because they've got it all projected, how many people there are in the neighborhood, how close the nearest shopping center is going to be, how fast everything builds up, how many minutes people have to spend getting to church. It shouldn't be more than 6 minutes. It's too long if it's more than 6 minutes. I had people coming 65 miles to church out there, one way. I've traveled one stretch of road that was 18 miles, and one time it took me an hour and 43 minutes to make the 18 miles when the sand had been blowing good for a while. But among these people, that they're neglected to some extent because they're not going to be an organized congregation within 5 years, they're not going to be self-supporting within 10, and they're not going to have their debt paid off to the district in 20. Now, I question the validity of those assumptions, and I'm making it more blanket maybe than it is, but I question the validity of that yardstick of measurement, whether that is a more needed ministry than the one, for instance, among the Navajo, or someone who live a lot more isolated and who maybe are going to be very slowly brought into the church, and maybe very slowly that a congregation will develop and everything. I realize we have to figure to some extent dollars and cents, but on the other hand, I think we better start looking at it and making our people look at it that, hey, it's not all that far to drive 15 minutes across St. Louis or Denver, that some of this money can be put in somewhere else. So, and as far as what we could do here, I think one thing that we could do is to, after all, you've got everything else. You've got a Stammtisch to learn German and to learn Spanish and all kinds of other things. There isn't any reason why we couldn't have an informal group to meet on some type of a regular basis since we don't have any actual classes offered, to begin something in the way of looking at culture and history and religion and other things like this. I think a lot of praying about it. And I think one thing that's going to be significant is if we've got enough men here who are interested in going into something like that, and to begin to make their voice heard then. And I mean this in a very good sense, both here at the seminary and the Synod. Professor Smelder?
Two things you may want to comment on. Most of your comments were directed to the reservation situation, except your brief reference to Phoenix. I think most people ought to be aware, at least in the West and Southwest, every major city has a large segment of ex-reservation people, or you might even have a whole community living in the city limits, like the Yaqui Indians south of Phoenix.
Or approximately 50,000 Indians living in L.A. itself, most of them in fairly well-defined neighborhoods because they want to stay together. And this is another thing. I missed it on my note that I'd wanted to touch there. We've got some educational opportunities right here in St. Louis because there's an American Indian Center here in St. Louis, down on Gravelly. And here could become a beginning of education, you know, in meeting that culture and everything. Yes, I think in some areas particularly, it's very significant that we need to work with these people in the urban areas. Now, both Southern California and Cal Nevada District are doing some work. But not to knock what's being done, but I'm afraid that unfortunately most of it, again, is of a purely social nature.
My second observation is that I usually don't tell you this, but you are more charitable today than you have in another circumstance. But your remarks about the NILB were decidedly loving and I don't know if that's moderate the way you were so kind to that. But I think at least we ought to be able to say in the context of this situation, many of our problems in Indian work can be traced back to the basic theological underpinnings or lack thereof that came out of the NILB. And you both attended enough meetings to know that you constantly hear stuff, don't bring them all your theological baggage. Is it really necessary for them to believe in Jesus as Savior in order to be saved, which I found a profoundly simple question to answer. I mean, you remember the statement that the three meetings to come out with, and finally to go Mennonite Chippewa to tell a bunch of Lutheran theologians that by traditionalism you'd never get to the cross. But there were a number of Lutheran theologians who really thought we should not be that hung up on our theology.
My tape's run out, and I'm supposed to give a copy of it to people down at the 500 building, so I'll take a chance on the other tape recorder, yeah, and I'll answer it. They know down there anyway how I feel. I think probably everybody in Synod who's had anything to do with Indians, including Andy Reinapp, know very well how I feel about it. I think, by and large, it's a bunch of garbage. Which again may be a very nice way of putting it. Some Navajo might hear the tape sometime. No, I'm serious. I think in some instances it's been nothing less than a catastrophe. I know that for one thing, no one involved in American Indian ministries, as far as pastors, were ever being invited to these things. In fact, they didn't want you to come, up until after the 1979 convention, which had followed the call of the board of directors to withdraw from it. Now, all of a sudden, you start getting invitations to come to these things. If you're not going to clean house, at least you put a coat of paint on over the dirt or something. The first one that I found out that there was a Southwest regional meeting of it, the first one of those I found out about, I attended. I invited myself. I was sort of uninvited, but I stayed anyway. And I found out that there were three members who were the board of directors for the Southwest region of the NILB. One of them was a Mennonite, and two of them were traditionalists. And they were telling the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod how we should spend our Indian funding.